Welcome to the Lost Together podcast. First, let's meet the host. Matt Wardlaw has been interviewing, writing, and talking about music in print and on the radio for over 20 years. The Lost Together podcast features in-depth discussion and debate with special guest contributors and also conversations with artists, producers, and music industry professionals. New and classic artists join us to share stories and insights regarding their musical process. Let's get started.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of the podcast, and this week I'm really thrilled to share a conversation with you that I had just about a week ago with producer Tony Visconti. Now, Tony joins me to talk about Holy Holy, the all-star lineup featuring Tony with drummer Woody Woodmansey, vocalist Glenn Gregory of Heaven 17, and a bunch of other cool folks. And in the fall of 2014, Tony and Woody shared the stage together for the first time since 1971, performing David Bowie's classic The Man Who Sold the World album in its entirety. Tony gives us the story on how all of that came together. At the same time, he continues to work with David Bowie. He was behind the boards for Bowie's surprise album The Next Day, which was released in March of 2013, and he was there again, working as co-producer on Black Star, Bowie's brand new record, which will be released on January 8th. Tony and Woody will bring Holy Holy to the U.S. for a string of 11 shows beginning on January 7th in Portland, Maine at the Asylum, and the tour wraps up on January 21st in Boston at the Wilbur Theater, and we are so thrilled. January 16th, Cleveland gets a date at the Odeon Concert Club. I'll put a link to the tour dates in the show notes for this show. As I mentioned, there are currently only 11 U.S. shows at the moment, but the word is that if these shows do well, they'd love to do more U.S. dates. You can visit Holy Holy online at holyholy.co.uk, and Woody is online at woodywoodmansey.co.uk, and there are frequent news updates at both sites. Tony's also on Twitter. His Twitter address is a bit complicated, so I'll put that in the show notes as well, so you can just click through directly to that. I had a half hour of talk time with Tony, and understandably, they ask us to keep the conversation focused on Holy Holy and the upcoming tour, so we talk a lot about that and the Man Who Sold the World album, but Tony also shares his thoughts on the Black Star album, and in the closing moments of the interview, I hit him with a couple of quick questions about his work with the Moody Blues. Certainly, if you're a Bowie fan, there's a lot of good Bowie-related chatter here in the interview, so I think you'll enjoy it. It was a lot of fun speaking with Tony, and the time went by quickly. I'd love to go a second round with him at some point, because if you look at the discography of the work that this man has done, it's unbelievable. You'll get tired just reading it. He's written a great autobiography about his life and experiences that I'll link in the show notes that'll give you a great fly-on-the-wall perspective for his career. So, thank you so much for listening. Let's get into the interview. We are so stoked that the Holy Holy Tour is coming to the States, and obviously, for the uninitiated, I mean, this is you and Woody and an all-star lineup performing the whole Man Who Sold the World record. And I know that you guys did this for the first time back in the fall of 2014, and I wondered what the spark was for the original idea to mount this show.
Well, the original spark came from Woody himself. He emailed me and he said, "How would you like to perform The Man Who Sold the World live? We never did it." And I said, and I wrote back, I said, "You're absolutely right. We never did it." And that's how, and then I thought to myself, I didn't give him an answer yet. I thought to myself, can I still play this album? And I do listen to it from time to time. And I did listen to it from time to time. And I thought, wow, you know, I played some cool stuff on the bass. I can't remember how I did any of that, but I'll have to relearn it. So I just had a kind of a little cursory, fool around with it. I played with the album for a couple of days and I said, well, there's a lot there I have to relearn because a lot of it was improvised in the studio and never played the same way twice afterwards. But the truth is we did break up after The Man Who Sold the World. David went with a new manager who promptly, we turned in this great album and his manager, who was Tony DeFreeze, said, drop the band. You don't need a band.
Oh, wow.
And I know, and that was devastating news to us. That's the only reason why we never performed it live. And David took his advice, and we all went our separate ways. I went on to produce Mark Bolan and T-Rex, and Woody and Mick Ronson returned home to Hull, where they lived, you know, and with no prospect of work. The carpet was just pulled right out from under us. So anyway, I did eventually, Woody wrote me a second email. He said, like, I'm sure you can believe this, but when the fuck are you going to return my email? Have you been reading my email? Something like that. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. And then I got really nervous after I said I'd do it. It took me about 2-3 months to really learn that album and get back into shape.
Well, you guys have done a decent number of shows at this point. How quickly did it come together on the stage in a way where it felt like you guys were in the zone?
Okay, well, we were all practicing our parts. Everyone had their job to do it. And I know the two guitarists, they listened to the records and, you know, tried to recreate Mick Ronson's parts, which were pretty difficult. Of course, we needed two guitarists to do that because even though Mick was playing on the record, he double-tracked a lot, and he played more than up to three parts on some songs. So to do it live, a second guitarist was absolutely necessary. And everyone did their homework, including myself. As I said, I studied for 3 months. Then we got together in London, and we had about 4 days rehearsal. And it was magic. I mean, it was there right from the start. The chemistry was perfect. I mean, I've got photos of those rehearsals. We're smiling all the time. You know, we're like pinching ourselves. And, you know, you don't often get a second chance in life to revisit something like that and get a chance to maybe make it sound a little bit better. But I knew from within the first hour or two that this was going to sound better than the original. And my choice of vocalist was absolutely perfect. But in Glenn Gregory, because we're not a Bowie tribute band. We don't want it to sound like Bowie. We don't want a lead singer who dyes his hair orange and all that. Glenn couldn't do that anyway. He's bald. but he turned out he's got this big voice, and he's a very interpretive singer. Like, he'll take... I worked with him before, and you give him a song, and he'll do it his way, but he can make you cry. You know, he's so emotional and passionate when he sings. And I don't know if you can ask me this question, but we knew it was right in rehearsal, but everyone was a little worried, will the fans accept this? You know, because that really, by all rights, that should be David Bowie up there singing his own songs. But since we couldn't get David Bowie, you know, we were lucky to get Glenn. And within the middle of the first song, which is Width of a Circle, we had the audience, like, just ecstatic. But I did see when we walked out on stage, we got a big round of applause and all that, but I could see some skeptics in the audience saying, really frowning, like, these guys better be good, you know, and all that. But we knew we were onto something good. As I say, it's not a tribute band. Woody and I are the original musicians. We're just doing an album that we created years ago, and we very much created our own parts as well.
Well, and I was listening to the 2015 remaster of the record on headphones, and I mean, it is still an astounding listen all these years later. And I have kind of a related question to this, but, you know, you and Bowie always made such interesting sounding records. And as you well know, these days it's so easy just to layer things and add track after track after track. It must have been really interesting in the analog days building the sonic concept for a song like All the Mad Men.
Yeah, yeah. I have, you know, we recorded on 16 track on most of that album, and we had ideas that went far beyond 16 tracks could give us. And I recently found, literally found last night, a copy of a little diagram. I couldn't understand what this diagram meant, but it was like a triangle pointing to a point. And it was actually a chart for us. See, I mean, in those days, you didn't put on backing vocals as an afterthought. You had to plan, especially backing vocals, earlier in the production, while you had some free tracks. So, for instance, we would record our backing vocals over four tracks, but we'd have to bounce them down to one or two tracks so we could make room for the other overdubs. So, making an album in those days took a serious amount of planning and conceptualizing too. Which, as you said, Matt, that today people they keep throwing it on, you know, we'll throw this on, we'll throw that on, and we'll see how it comes out in the mix. We'll see what we keep in the mix. And to me, you know, records don't sound, they don't have that kind of depth that we did, because we were writing it as we were playing it, you know. And we had these conversations before we went in the studio, how to proceed on a 16-track machine. And there's an amazing song called After All, which has got a lot of overdubs on it, but that was our only 8-track recording on the album. We started that on 8-track machine.
Oh, wow.
To save some money, you know. So you can see all those bounces, all those backing vocals, the synthesizers. That had to be really planned, you know, to condense about 18, 19 elements onto 8 tracks, you know, played by the same people, of course.
Well, and listening to this record, as I mentioned, listening to it on headphones, I mean, it kind of brings out something else that you don't hear a lot of these days, that, like, when I'm listening to this record on headphones, it seemed like you guys were thinking about the experience that folks were going to have, not just, you know, coming out of traditional speakers, but for the folks that do put the headphones on that were listening to that record, you guys were thinking about, like, how that was going to sound and, you know, and how it was going to lay out on, you know, channel to channel.
Well, that's true. We did. We made a headphone record. And I remember always monitoring the mixes as we made them. And I handed the headphones to Mick Ronson once during the mixing process. And I said, Mick, I will listen to this on the stereo on headphones. He says, I'm deaf in one ear. I can't hear stereo. And it was his years of guitar playing where he used to put the left, you know, the guitar body up against his Marshall stack to control the feedback, and he would be getting like 150 watts in his right ear. To, you know, he stood that close to the amp, and he made himself almost deaf in the right ear. But that is an interesting point, that the album has so much stereo information on it. Mick was part of the process, but he couldn't actually hear it. The other thing is, and it's no secret, in those days, people were lighting up spliffs and smoking bowls of marijuana and putting on headphones, hearing something that the mind, in its very lucid state, would add the rest. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, for sure.
So we used to mix the heads, you know, blatantly. Like, will the heads like this mix? Will, you know, is there enough information there to freak people out, or are the depth, you know? Well, we would particularly put layers of information that we'd hope, but we would be subtle. Then we'd ask ourselves, is this too subtle in the mix? So should it be louder and all that? Because I listened to music like that in those days. I still love to listen to music high, and you would hear other stuff that, you know, the mind and the real music create magic together, you know. I'm not saying you have to get high to hear music, but it is an added bonus, I have to tell you.
Well, so that brings me back to kind of the second part of why I brought up a song like All the Bad Men, and that was listening to the record and thinking about, you know, you guys, like, say, putting this together for the stage all of these years later. You mentioned already kind of how you went about addressing, like, say, all the guitar parts that, like, say, Mick had laid down. But I wondered, like, just with the various elements, sometimes there's a lot of elements that are in the mix of these songs. How much did you have to work on, like, you know, coming up with arrangements that would really kind of address and include all the stuff that you felt were important things to include when you guys were playing these songs on the stage?
Well, the present day?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Well, we wanted everything on the record to be heard on stage, and nothing pre-recorded. We insist on playing live, everything live. Nothing is pre-recorded. So we got our keyboard player, Berenice Scott, has a couple of keyboards where she has samples of recorders that we on All the Mad Men. Mick and I are playing recorders in the middle bit. On all over the album, Mick and I were recorder players, so we did the recorder stuff. She has samples, and then my daughter Jessica is playing one recorder part on her lead, on her backing vocal mic. So we have everything on the record included in the live show. The two guitarists do all the Mick Ronson stuff. I've got special effects on my bass, which recreates the bass sound on After All was I played four basses on that track, a bowed bass, upright bass, and kind of I think a fretless and a fretted bass together to get a really flangey sound. So I have an effect which is really getting very, very close to that sound. So when you hear After All, it's going to be like the record too.
Very cool.
What other thing? We're paying attention to anything that, where there's a saxophone or a 12-string guitar. We have Terry Edwards, who is both the saxophonist and the 12-string guitarist on the album. So we recreate the album, but the texture of the album is there in the live performance. And we drop the keys a little bit to accommodate Glenn Gregory's range. But I have to point out that in later years, David dropped the keys on all his songs when he went out playing live. I mean, he sang ridiculously high in those days, which he kind of lost that range after the years grew. And maybe smoking had something to do with that, too. But anyway, the album, consequently, 80% of the texture is definitely there in the live version. But it sounds a little different. It's darker and heavier. And almost all the notes are the same, but, you know, if we played that live in those days, we would have evolved. We might be playing stuff on the stage, you know, 6 months after we recorded it, we might have been playing a different The Man Who Sold the World album anyway. Things just evolve, you know. So we're not doing an anal recreation, if that answers your question, but it's all there. All the material is there. All the stuff is there. The texture is there.
Well, it does answer the question, and you mentioned Glenn Gregory, kind of how he came to the band and that you'd worked with him before. Is that kind of true of the other folks that ended up rounding out the Holy Holy lineup? Was a lot of it folks that you'd worked with in the past?
No, I depended on, for the guitarist, I depended on Woody. And he had worked with James Stevenson and Paul Cutterford, and also the producer of the London shows, Tom Wilcox, has a fund of, like, his Rolodex is full of great musicians who are specifically Bowie aficionados, you know. So James grew up playing these licks, you know. James is fantastic. He does, between him and Paul, you know, especially his song like She Shook Me Cold, which you will believe how great that sounds live. Paul memorized Mick Ronson's solo. And James, like, for instance, Life on Mars, they swap solos, but between the two of them, they know all of Mick Ronson's solos. So most of the time, you can hear the exact solos played as they originally were, with the same tone, same equipment. So these guys are experts, and I relied on Woody. I haven't lived in London since 1989, so I was a little out of touch with the best musicians in London. And this is a new crew. Anyway, these are all young men, you know. It's very refreshing.
Well, were you surprised that you were able to bring this thing over to the U.S. for a U.S. tour? Like, I know we're really happy it's coming to the U.S., but were you surprised that this, like, proved to be a viable enough thing that you could take it overseas?
I'm very happy about this because a lot of people, you know, spent a lot of money to fly over to England to hear the show. A lot of Bowie fans came from America. And, you know, obviously not everyone could do that. And I had so many hundreds of emails, and then Facebook comments. When are you coming to Cleveland? When are you coming to, you know, New Jersey? When are you coming to L.A. and all that? I said, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And we had to figure out how to do it. Unfortunately, we lost our producer, Tom Wilcox, who is a busy man. He got us to Tokyo, but, I mean, he kind of dropped out and said, you guys are on your own. I'll help any way I can. So we have a new manager now called Tom Vitorino, who works with The Cure, and he's in L.A. He was very, very instrumental in getting us over here and helping us organize the tour. So, and he's a Bowie fan, you know, like... We got lucky two times now with the right person who's actually supervising everything. I mean, we're all very much involved in the aspects of how we put the show on, what gear we're going to use, the rig and all that. And this will be my first time sleeping on a bus for 2 weeks, by the way. All that has to be figured out. You know, what do you bring on a bus? I have no idea. But I bring something.
I guess at least you're not
going...
No, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. No, I'm saying there are enough Bowie fans here who want to hear this record, so I'm really pleased about that. The sales have been very good, and people like yourself want to speak to me about it, so that's a good sign that there's enough interest here.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Now, this was your second record working with Bowie. I mean, it represents a pretty significant shift in sound, and I wondered from your perspective, what was driving that sound and directionally where the songwriting went on the record?
Well, we made Space Oddity, and it was in the beginning when I started to work with him, his publisher gave me a brief. He said, the problem we have with David Bowie is he writes in too many different styles, which obviously in later years that worked for him. But in the beginning, he was writing songs like for the stage, you know, a Broadway musical or the British musical stage. And he was all over the place. He wanted to be he wrote some jazz kind of jazz songs and all that. But one thing he was getting good at was writing, just picking up his acoustic guitar and doing kind of folk rock songs in the style of, saying, you know, Mamas and the Papas or solo Donovan kind of songs and all that. And I put him together with a rock band I was working with, and that kind of was the way we went on the first album. But we weren't happy with that. He's more than a folk rock artist, you know. And he had a lot in him. He had a lot of different aspects that needed to come out. So we felt that the only way to go would become a rock band. And that was a definite conscious shift from just doing a studio album to having a band full time that we would work together all the time, and we ended up living together. And he was introduced to us, Mick Ronson was introduced to us by one of his former drummers, John Cambridge, who was also in the group Rats, that, you know, when they all lived up in Hull in the north of England.
Mm-hmm.
So when Mick Ronson came into our lives, it was almost like the answer to a prayer, like he was the one. he had all the guitar chops and the licks and the sound and the look. And we looked up to him. We thought Mick was amazing. And he told me, he says, well, if I'm going to be in this band, you have to learn to play like Jack Bruce. And David, you're going to have to write rock songs. And, you know, he kind of came with a list of requirements.
Wow.
And which we love. We love this about him. We absolutely love this. And then we found this apartment in the south of London where we all managed to live together. I mean, it was only meant to house four people at the most. But at one point, we had about 12 people living there. And that's how we got this album together. We had a converted wine cellar in the basement. And we converted it to a little rehearsal studio. We pushed some foam rubber on the walls and all that. And we wrote that album collectively downstairs in that wine cellar. So that was a big difference. That was a big change.
Well, the timing of this activity with Holy Holy is somewhat unique because there are some folks that might do something like this who have a past link to whatever it is that they're doing. And in this case, you are still connected with, and you've been working with David over the past few years on new music. And I wondered what sort of thoughts he's shared with you about this project.
Well, he liked the idea. And when I told him about it, I said, you know, this is back 2014. I said, Woody's been hounding me to get together to do this album. And he says, well, why not? If you enjoy doing it, do it. You know, he didn't endorse it. But he's so open. Like, he's a very free, open, liberal person. He approved of the fact that I was going to do it. And then when I got closer and closer to the date, I said, you know, this is really sounding good. I think it's going to be really, really great. So I know he's seen a couple of YouTube videos of it. He really liked what he saw. The only comment he made that I thought was really touching, he said, if we stayed together, we would have sounded this good. He goes, I wish we did perform this out live. So we have an unofficial approval of what we're doing. He's never actually been to a show, and nor will he ever appear in one of our shows. But it's a side project. For me, it's a side project, and he's like in total approval because he loves that album. He's very proud of The Man Who Sold the World.
Well, 2013 sees the arrival of the Next Day record quite unexpectedly, and you guys were working on that record for a decent length of time, and I wondered, how does one keep the recording of a David Bowie album under tight wraps in today's internet age, especially when you're doing it in New York City at a place like the Magic Shop that, I mean, it's relatively well known?
I think it would have been discovered if we were recording it in some small town in upstate New York. I think everybody would know that David Bowie's making an album, say, in Woodstock. New York is just an incredible, it's so busy, nobody even knows. You know, no, everyone's concerned with walking down the street, looking at their cell phones and all that. He was clearly walking from his home to the studio every day and not spotted. Earl Slick was standing outside having a cigarette outside the Magic Shop, and people would say, "Hey, you're Earl Slick, are you?" He'd go, "Yeah," but they wouldn't know that there was David Bowie was inside, you know. But we all adore David. We're all loyal to him, and if he says keep it secret, we'll keep it a secret. I mean, on the last album we did, the Black Star,
yep.
Our engineer told me he didn't even tell his wife he was working with David Bowie. So that's amazing. It's kind of fun, you know, in a way. It's kind of fun to keep a secret like that. I mean, there's so many times I wanted to blurt it out, but when that day comes that the world knows, it gives me goosebumps, you know.
Oh, for sure.
Goosebumps. But it was easy to keep the secret, no problem. As I said, he was the weakest link. He was every day walking to the studio. I mean, people just didn't put two and two together.
That's so funny. And you mentioned the Black Star record. And as a guy who has been a part of the process of so much music and so many albums with David, what sticks out about this one for you?
Well, this one, he kind of dropped the rock concept of an album. You know, we usually have an album with at least four guitarists on it. And this one, we had only one guitarist, but we had a jazz band. That was the difference. Modern jazz, really ultra modern jazz, because these guys in Donnie McCaslin's group are very, you know, well trained, well educated musicians. I mean, they probably have a couple of degrees between them, but they play a very modern style of jazz, which is kind of based on everything that's gone before. Like they obviously know about Charlie Mingus and Charlie Parker. But they grew up listening to Dr. Dre and, like, more modern people. The saxophonist was in Maria Schneider's orchestra. He played on that single we made in 2014 called Sue.
Uh-huh.
And Mark Juliana, the drummer, he's 32. He's all into hip-hop beats and all that. But he can play straight-up jazz, too. So we had this particular band interpret David Bowie's music. And there's a rock element to it, but it's not as obvious as it's not jazz either. It's in between the two worlds, and this is something David is always good at, and we even have a name for it called hybridism. He's really good at taking two genres and sticking them together. And I'll give you an obvious, for instance, there's a record on what is it called? Larger. Called Yassassin,
mm-hmm.
And that's a combination of Jamaican reggae and Turkish music.
Oh yeah,
who would
sure.
think of putting those two? Who would put? And we recorded it in Berlin with a black musicians and an English nobleman like Brian Eno. He's not a nobleman actually, but you know, it's like. So here we are. This is hybridism at its best. You know, you can't get more hybrid than that. So I think David's always had that element in a lot of his work. He puts two things that you wouldn't think would go together. You know, two ingredients, and he creates something new. So I don't really know, honestly, Matt, what to call this genre, what to call this music. But it's the only way he could have gone forward when you think about it. To make something really new from David Bowie. It's the only way the only thing he could have done.
Well,
we could have gotten the old gang back. You know, we could have gotten the old gang back. They might reemerge someday too. But this is a great departure. I think it's very refreshing.
And I think that, you know, hearing that this was kind of a jazzy record from Bowie kind of scared some people, but it's like, I got to tell you, when I heard, I mean, the title track, I mean, clocking in at 10 minutes, I mean, I could not wait to hear this record. I mean, as you mentioned, Bowie has always done things very experimentally, and this record seems to continue on that path.
Yeah. Yes, it does. And I mean, he had some flirtations with jazz musicians in the past, you know, to some success. And but this is really, we went all the way on this, you know, to see what would happen. And of course, one main reason for the secrecy is he always says that this album's going to be an experiment. It might not work. So he would rather not announce the news to the world that he was making a new album, just in case he didn't like it. You know, that's the only reason. And at some point we said, yeah, we didn't know. Like, we recorded a few months, and then it became apparent we did have a great album. And then he said, okay, this is it. We might have even finished it and not released it. I mean, that's happened to other artists, I know. But at least he has that safety net that he's not under pressure any longer. He doesn't have to tell the world he's making an album and then come up with the goods. He'll tell you when he came up with the goods. You don't have to tell him to make that album. You know, that's the difference.
Well, a couple final questions here. One, with Holy Holy, I want to ask, what are your plans long term with this? Would you like to make a record?
Well, we were talking about doing original material, and we might just do that. But for right now, it's just, for me, it's just a side thing. You know, I love doing it. It's a healthy thing to do. I love playing bass. I love getting up on stage. I love the energy. But we'd have to seriously put our heads together and come up with some new material. And I have no idea what form that would take. First thing I would do is ask David to write us a song if we were serious about doing that. But if it's not going to be great music, I wouldn't bother making it just for the sake of making it. We'd have to have some real high-level talks amongst ourselves before we would embark on such a project.
That makes sense. And I wanted to just ask you briefly about the Moody Blues. I mean, what we now call classic rock bands like the Moody Blues, there were a lot of them that were in a pretty weird spot figuring out how to fit into the musical culture of what was happening musically in the 80s. And those albums certainly sound like they are of a certain time now. But in that era, I thought they made a few solid records, you know, with you, you know, The Other Side of Life, I mean, Sir Lamar, and, you know, Keys of the Kingdom. I was surprised to read in your book about the difficulties behind the scenes. I mean, I guess, you know, at a younger age, with the vibes of peace and love and positivity that those guys kind of projected lyrically and musically, you wouldn't have necessarily guessed that was going on behind the scenes. So I guess my question was, how did you go about making a record with these guys in that era that would, I guess, be true to what they were about, but also fit into what was going on at the time? How hard was it to pull that off?
Every group is like a brotherhood. They're like brothers, and brothers quarrel. I don't know of any family who has siblings who don't quarrel. In fact, there's probably more quarreling going on between brothers than anything else. But that was the problem. They grew older, and they all had their idea of what the Moody Blues were supposed to be, and that was the conflict. They had different ideas. For instance, Graham, the drummer, just saw them as an experimental band. They had to go far out. They had to write songs about the cosmos, how human nature is evolving and how aliens live among us. And then Justin was writing his poetic, artistic, you know, the beautiful love songs, some of them. And he kind of was continuing his Knights in White Satin. And John Lodge wanted to have hit singles. You know, they all had different purposes. And to get it all on one album was difficult. And by the time I worked with them, they were separate entities. You know, they all had made their solo albums. It was really hard to pull it all together. However, we did it in the end. You know, there were conflicts, but I love the albums I did with them. I'm very, very proud of them. And I got them I got everyone what they wanted. I got them their hit single, their hit album. You know, it all worked out perfectly.
Did those...
They hadn't recorded in 10 years. You know, there's
yeah.
10 years since they would recorded, so it was really good.
Your Wildest Dreams, and I know you're out there somewhere, those are beautiful radio singles. Did those come in? Did Justin bring those in, you know, fully formed like that? Or did you guys develop them?
They were, he made home demos, and we spent months making the Wildest, Your Wildest Dreams took about 3 months to make, and we kept adding it. We kept developing it and refining it in the studio. And the same goes with the second album we did. Like, it was the longest. That first album I did with them was a 9-month project.
Oof.
Almost constant recording. Daily, yeah. So that's how we got there in the end. Yeah, just keep at it.